welcome. India is the most depressed country in the world, according to the World Health Organization. At 36%, this is the highest rate of depression anywhere on the globe. We also have the highest suicide rate of any country in the world. Over 1 lakh people on average kill themselves in India every year. And these are only the reported figures of depression and suicide. Yet despite these statistics, there continues to be an absolutely unneeded stigma, a sense of embarrassment when it comes to talking about depression or mental health. There is also a sense of denial. People look at mental health in a way that they do not look at physical health, almost as if to suggest that it's in the control of the person impacted to do something about it. Today on this program, we want to break through the shroud of silence that has enveloped the conversation around depression and mental health. And somebody who helped us do that very, very bravely was Deepika Padukone when she went public with her own struggles with depression, her own battles with depression. And today on this program, talking on television about this battle for the very first time, in the hope that others may also draw some help from it, we are joined by Deepika herself. We're also joined by her mother, Ujjwala Padukone, and the two doctors who talked Deepika through, helped her through this, and are also here to talk about how other people who are battling this may actually derive help. We have Dr. Shyam Bhatt and Dr. Anna Chandy. And Deepika, thank you. And I say thank you because this is not about a movie, this is not about entertainment, this is not a promotional program. This is intensely personal to you. And at the best of times, even those of us who are less in the public eye are scared to go public with something this personal. So before we talk about what you actually went through, why is it important for you to talk to a larger audience? Why are we on television talking about depression?
I think, Barkha, for the same reasons that you just pointed out right now, the rates at which people are committing suicide, or the number, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think one in every four, one in every three, one in every four people is depressed. It's not like any other medical symptom where you actually see the physical symptoms. If you have diabetes or anything, if you have a headache, you know, these are things that for some reason people easily accept. But strangely, when it comes to the mind, people sort of feel like, you know,
it's in your control.
It's in your control, and no, everything will be fine. And, you know, like someone will come and nudge you and say, come on, cheer up, and it's all okay. And I think a lot of it is also because of lack of knowledge, you know, or even if people are aware of, you know, mental illness, I think there's a sort of stigma attached to it, which is, you know, let's not talk about it. You can't take medication for your mind and for your brain. You know, nobody does that. What are other people going to think? You're going to lose your job. The reason why I chose to speak up, I think, is because if in doing so, if I can impact even one life, because I lost a friend a couple of months ago. And so for me, I think if I can impact even one life in this entire process of speaking up and letting people know that, you know what, it's something that I've been through. And something that I could deal with because I had a fantastic support system. A lot of times it's not just the person who's suffering. You know, there are a lot of people who are ready and willing to take that help, but it's the immediate family and friends around who sort of suppress them and say, no, you can't go to a doctor. Nobody does this. What are other people going to say? And I think, which is why it's important that my mother's here for me today, because she's the one who sort of encouraged me. I mean, I realized something was wrong. I realized that I was being different. I couldn't pinpoint what the issue was.
What did you feel exactly?
So it all started on the 15th of Feb last year, when I suddenly woke up one morning and where, you know, I'd won all my awards and, you know, all the appreciation for 2013. Everything had happened. It was a great time. And obviously everyone's going to think like, why is she depressed? You know, she's got everything going for her. But I woke up one morning just feeling empty, you know, like this pittish feeling in my stomach. I woke up like feeling directionless. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to do. I'd have these bouts of feeling so low that I'd just start crying at the drop of a hat. And luckily at that time, you know, they'd come and they come every few months and spend some time with me. And actually, that was the day that, I think a day or two after that, they were leaving or something like that. And they were getting ready to go to the airport. And I usually, you know, go and sit with them in the room before they leave. And I started crying. And so she said, oh, you know, are you okay? And, you know, like, I know, because it's always tough to leave family. Every time I go to Bangalore and I have to leave, or they come to Bombay, it's tough. So she thought maybe it's one of those, you know, like, don't worry, we'll be back soon sort of thing. And I kept crying. And I think she could sort of sense that something was wrong. She asked me if it had something to do with my personal life. She said, is it your work? Has someone said something to you? And it was none of these reasons. And she sort of sensed that something was wrong. And you know, I think she changed her ticket. And then she said, you know what, she told my dad, she said, you carry on, because we have a younger sister also who you know, they have to take care of. And that went on for almost a month. And, you know, she'd never leave my side. She was just with me all the time. But the time before that, before this, before she realized and before... So I would keep crying, you know. I couldn't understand what was happening to me. There were times where I'd feel okay and there were times where I'd feel really low, including airports. You know, I'd board a flight and land somewhere. And I remember attending a conclave exactly this year, last time. And that was the first initial days. And I'd cry in my room, and then I had to go down and give this talk in front of so many people.
With
and
a smile plastered
with a
on your
smile
face,
on my face, like everything's okay. And that entire session was about being number one. And I was sitting in my room crying, and then here I have to go and talk about achieving everything that I have. And then I had to fly back, and then I'd land, and again I'd have to like lock myself up in a bathroom and cry, because there's just so many people looking at you all the time. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever end up just losing control in front of people as well on set during a shoot?
No, even on set, I'd go to my van and cry, or, you know. Sometimes being out around people helped, but sometimes it didn't help. Again, I don't think that's in my control, and I don't think that it's in control of the people who are surrounding me either.
Yeah.
Went abroad for an award show. I thought, you know, going all the way to America, maybe I'll just feel better just getting away. Again, when I was out and about and with people, I'd feel okay. When I came back to my room, I wouldn't feel okay. You know, there were days when I'd wake up and feel like it was just too exhausting. You know, it was just too exhausting. I didn't want to wake up. There were days where I just wanted to be in bed, just sleep, not wake up.
It's difficult to talk about, isn't it? And I'm sorry, we don't want to upset you, but it is that intense that even today it will bring these tears.
It's definitely scary. I mean, and I think that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, because it's been so hard for me that I don't want anyone else to go through it.
Thank you for talking to us. And I know, I mean, none of us can actually know what you went through, but I have some sense of how difficult this is for you. And as her mom, to watch her go through this has to be the toughest thing for a parent, right?
As a parent, you don't want any of your family members to be ill in any way. That was the first thing. The second pressure was, you don't want, you know, for someone like her, you don't want the outside world to know what's happening, because then there are all kinds of stories that will go around and all kinds of things being written about. So it was that added pressure as well. But I mean, I could sense, because she's normally a very happy person, and she's a very strong person. She can take on, you know, practically anything in life. So her constant breaking down itself alerted me, and I knew immediately that this is an ailment. It's
you know what you say is important, that for Deepika to talk about this is actually different from me talking about it, or Shyam talking about it, Anna talking about it. And even now, Deepika, as you talk about this and you're crying on national television, is there a part of you that's scared that A, I've bared myself to the world, I have bared my soul to the world, and here I'm in this vanity industry, this creative industry that has to sell fantasy, that has to sell dreams. But what I've actually done is I've opened the door and I've allowed people into my private hell. And you know, I just think it's so extraordinarily courageous of you to A, talk about it, and to B, not put up a wall to your emotion, that you're able to cry honestly and openly, I think is brave. But is there a part of you that's scared? Oh, people are watching me cry. People right now are going to look at me different because I've cried about being depressed.
No, not really, because I think I'm looking at the larger picture, and this is really not about me right now. I think it's really about the lives that hopefully we will impact, for everyone who's watching this interview, and for people who have been through or are going through right now, or for families whose somebody dear to them is going through it. I hope that they take this as an example and they listen to what we're saying and hopefully help the people around them. And for me, that is more important. Even if we can impact one life or save that one person from taking their life because they're so down and out, I think we've achieved what we wanted to.
Did you worry on her behalf? Did you ever think, let the world not find this out, this would affect her image, how people, you know, those of us who are in the public eye, and Deepika so much more than any of us.
No,
there's that relationship you have with the anonymous person, and you need to think about how that stranger is looking at you.
It has never bothered me about the world getting to know or about her image as a star. What bothers me is when the right information doesn't come out.
Yeah.
When it gets distorted, when it gets blown out of proportion, when people start saying things that are not true, that is perhaps what would bother me, though I, over the years now, I've learned to distance myself from situations like that.
I think this is the right time for me to say, you know, I think after my article came out, couple of weeks ago, there was a publication that carried like a gossip item, and so carelessly spoke about how I was depressed, but I was depressed because a friend of mine, Ranveer, was depressed, and he was depressed, and that's why. I mean, we need to be a little more careful, we need to be a little more sensitive. You know, calling someone clinically depressed without even having picked up the phone and cross-checking, or just writing in the manner that they did, you know, I think we need to become a little more sensitive about how we write about these things.
I've even read in some columns and some gossip pieces that this is all one promotional stunt. I mean, have you heard that? For me, that's as low as it gets. For me, that's as gross, frankly, as it gets.
Of course, there are people who are going to think, oh, it's timed with some film release.
Yeah.
Or there are people who are going to say, oh, she's getting paid for supporting a cause like this. And really, Barkha, you know, I think for me, I've been through hell and back. And like I said, I think for me, there's just a larger issue at hand. If we're a nation that's the most depressed in the world, there's definitely a much, much larger issue that we all need to sort of focus on and work towards.
Now, how did you meet Anna and Shyam? Before I get them in, Ujwala, if you can tell us, how did you actually say to Deepika that you need to confront this? We need to go and see a doctor. And I ask this because when it comes to the mind, there is immense resistance in all of us.
Yeah.
That little cliche, iska to dimag kharab hai.
Yeah.
This is the kind of silly attitude that we are brought up on. And we don't want to believe ki hamara dimag kharab hai. So we resist going to a doctor.
Yeah.
We resist that. We resist acknowledging that we are not just sad, that there's something wrong with us, that we need medical help.
Yeah.
How did you convince her? How did we end up going to doctors?
First and foremost, I want to say that being alert helps a lot. Whether it's the family, whether it's close friends, whether it's your colleagues at work, don't assume when a person is crying, breaking down or crying all the time, don't assume that they're doing it for attention or don't assume they're going through mood swings. If it's happening repeatedly, have a chat with them, find out what's bothering them, and then try to get in a counselor, convince the person that you need to see a counselor. And then if required, it's the counselor who will put you on to a doctor. And the person concerned needs a lot of convincing. You need to convince them that, look, just as it's like any other ailment, just as you could be having any other physical ailment, this is a mind ailment. You need to see a doctor. You need to take medication.
But Deepika, did you see it like that? You know, one of the things that happens, and I remember there was this point in my life when I used to get panic attacks, and I would get these anxiety attacks just before I had to come onto television, and my producers would actually be handing me an Alprax to calm me down. But it took me many months before I realized that it was a panic attack. And when I was told, maybe you're depressed and you need antidepressants, I was like, no, I don't want to put chemicals in my brain. I mean, there was such resistance. And then I had other people who, even my friends, when they were being affectionate, they would say, oh, come on, Barkha, now don't do this drama. You know, and I don't know if you felt that isolation of people around you, not understanding how bad it was.
Yeah, and I think that's why I just really helped talking to Anna and doing a couple of sessions with her, because sometimes for people who don't really understand what anxiety and depression is all about, sometimes exactly what you said, like, hey, come on, you'll be okay, and like acting happy in front of the person or playing loud music, and actually had, at least on
the
me,
opposite
it
effect.
For me, it had the completely opposite effect. And I started questioning a lot of like strange questions in my head, like, oh, why is that person so happy? Then why am I so sad? And then I start feeling even worse. And I quickly want to say that there's a huge difference between being sad and being depressed. Sadness comes from a different place in my body and in my stomach. And being having anxiety and going through depression comes from a completely different, and it does something completely different to my body.
Yeah. Anna, so you've known the family for a long time. When you first had Deepika talking to you about this, were you able to immediately identify it as depression?
Yeah. So I received a phone call from Ujla saying that we need your help. Deepika's having some difficulty. So I asked Ujla if I could speak to Deepika. As soon as I started paying attention to Deepika, there was a certain quality in the tone of her voice that signaled to me that I need to come to Bombay because there's something more. It's not a temporary sadness. And that was from the quality of the tone of when she speaks, and she was also weeping on the phone. I came the next morning and I just spent the whole day with her. And at the end of the day, I recognized Deepika will need to consult a doctor for this.
A psychiatrist
for this.
On counseling. And Deepika, jump in here. You know, some of us who think of ourselves as reasonably bright often think we're smarter than the counselors. One of the resistance, I'm sure you felt this.
Absolutely.
You know, somebody says, why don't you go and see a therapist? Why don't you see a counselor? So what is she going to tell me? I know all of this. I know the problems in my life. I know the trigger points. I've read enough. I've had enough exposure. So did you ever feel, I know Anna was a family friend, but did you ever feel, why should I go to a doctor? Or
no.
Did you feel that helplessness that I need somebody to explain to me what the hell is going on with it?
Yeah, I definitely needed, because I had no knowledge, no understanding of what I was going through, why I was going through. I think the first step for me was to agree to what she was telling me to do, and a month later pick up the phone on her and speak to her, and again while I was talking to her I broke down, and I think she could sense in my voice that it was very, very different. And then this to this also.
Yeah, so this journey from counselor to psychiatrist, after all you're a family friend, you're not a stranger, so that makes it a little easier.
It did.
So it made it easier for her but difficult for me, because I recognized that I have two roles. One is that I'm a family friend, and therefore there is trust, there's dependability. And from a professional role, I knew that I cannot just do mere counseling. I need to seek additional support. So it took me a bit of time to convince Deepika. I would suggest, she would resist. 2 days later, I would suggest. So we went like this slowly, and finally she said, okay, you identify a doctor and we'll go together.
And so she goes to Shyam. Now the question is, this resistance, and I want you to talk about how you encountered it with Deepika and how you encountered it with other people. Because as I said, in my own case, where I didn't go through something as intense as Deepika, the moment there was a suggestion that you should be put onto medication, I immediately said, no, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I'll handle it. Did you find it was difficult to convince Deepika to go on to medication?
You see, broadly, every person, like you said, who goes through sadness, first and foremost, starts wrestling with themselves. Because we've all experienced sadness, but we assume the sadness is going to pass.
Yeah.
We also start feeling bad about our own sadness. There's a certain amount of guilt and shame associated with this condition, which is no other condition has it. If you have high blood sugar, you're not alone in your room feeling bad about your low blood sugar, you know.
Yeah.
With depression, it's a lonely, isolating, private condition that a person cannot even share in our country.
But why are we, all of us here, educated, liberal people,
right,
why are we not able to shake off the sense of embarrassment, guilt, shame?
Sure. I think it's the concept of the idea. I mean, the idea is that you're mad if there's something wrong with your
brain.
So I always tell people, are you in control of your brain? And people say yes. And I ask them, what is controlling your heart rate right now? They say, my brain. I say, can you lower your heart rate? No. we are not in full possession of control of our brain, just as we are not in control of our pancreas. We don't ask the diabetic to make more insulin to get more optimistic.
Yeah.
So one is the idea that there's something intrinsically wrong with me. That's one reason people don't seek help. The second is, this is something that's abnormal. Most people don't go through this. Is the second misconception. Someone, a person in the public eye like Deepika, for her to have the courage to come and talk about it.
Yeah, I think
to me as a psychiatrist, it's extraordinary. Because for the first time, people know that this is nothing shameful. Secondly, that anyone can get it. It's not a question of what your life is like. That's a huge misconception. Why are you depressed? You have nothing to be depressed about. Yeah. So you add guilt and you add shame. And at the end of it, we are perpetuating a problem that is not, everyone's going to face it. Either you are depressed or you know someone in your family who's depressed. It's that common. 36%.
And 36% of India is depressed. Yeah.
Now the question, of course, is it even a disorder at 36 to 40%, or is it, in my opinion, this is a result of a fast-changing society. And if we don't start learning how to prevent this, to treat this, we are in for a huge problem in about 10 or 20 years. Mm. Because we have a population which is, 70% under the age of 35. Now we have the highest suicide rates in the world in the 15 to 29 age group.
Yeah.
In one study, 10 times more than America. So this group is going to get older. We're not learning how to deal with our emotions in school. If we continue to face stigma, we'll have an epidemic, you know.
Talking of suicides, you mentioned that you lost a friend. What happened and how much of a catalyst was that in making you confront your demons, so to speak?
Okay. So it was a friend of a friend.
Okay.
But the point is that I knew this person.
Okay.
And he always came across as someone who was very happy with his life. If you just met him, you'd never think that he was depressed. I think it just made me realize that if someone so close to me can do this to themselves, and you read every day, you know, there's so many. Not everyone ends up taking their life, but there's a lot of people who are, like he said, fighting with themselves every morning. A lot of people on medication.
Were you scared that you'd start feeling like life is not worth living? Were you scared that somebody you knew had been suicidal and had taken his life?
That was later. My friend's incident happened much after I had recovered and I was completely okay.
Okay.
So that made me feel even more for him and made me understand what he must have gone through. And if we had seen the symptoms earlier, or if we had forced him to take his medication, or there's a lot of cases immediately around me that I see. So I think there's this constant thing of, I don't want to see a psychiatrist, I don't want to see a psychologist, I don't want to take medication. But I think we need to start treating it as we do to any other part of our body.
You said you never worried as a parent what this would do to Deepika's image as a star. But could you see the kind of irony of that whole moment, that there were going to be people, who would think she has everything she needs, B, that depression is still regarded as some sort of luxury disease, that almost as if you have to be rich and privileged to suffer it. So did you ever panic just a little bit that it will be double jeopardy for Deepika? She's spoken about it, people will look at her differently, and maybe that will just cause even more anxiety, even more stress in her life. I mean, was there ever an impulse in you, Deepika, let's not talk about this?
No, I'm both Prakash and me are extremely happy that she's chosen to express what she has gone through and wanting to impact a lot of other people. And it has not even once crossed our minds that it's going to affect her status of who she is.
Did it cross yours?
Not at all. But there are people who come up to me and say, but she's got everything in life.
Yeah.
What was the reason? And I have to tell them that doesn't have to be a particular reason. And so what if she's got everything in life? It's an ailment. I mean, an ailment can strike any person, irrespective of whether, you know, it doesn't matter where in society you are placed or what you have achieved or not achieved.
There is this assumption that somehow, you know, you can afford to be depressed. You know, people have that kind of scot. People do. People say, look at that poor person. He's so busy earning a living. Like I said, it's treated almost as a luxury. Did you have to sort of, I guess nobody would say it to your face, but did you feel like, people are going to look at me with a sense of scorn or contempt, or at least a lack of empathy?
I think most people understood, and I think the kind of messages that I got, the kind of support that I got after my first article that came out. Of course, there will always be that 5%, like we said, who'll say that she's doing it for publicity, or she's doing it because a film is coming up, or she's endorsing the cause and she's getting paid for it. Of course, there'll always be that 5%, but it's really 5%. And again, I think for me and with this cause, I'm really like with a horse with blinkers, and we have so much more to achieve. We're setting up the foundation now. Where, you know, I think for me, impacting lives and saving people is really way, way more important.
What is the foundation going to do?
I think the foundation, I mean, we're still in the process of setting it up, but it's called the Live, Love, Laugh Foundation. And other than, I think, creating awareness and trying to remove the stigma that is attached to mental illness is also going to be prevention, cure. As the foundation grows in scale, hopefully we'll be able to do a lot more. But I think this is what we're focusing on right now, is prevention, creating awareness, and to sort of remove the stigma, most importantly.
How commonplace, Shyam, is the stigma?
Stigma is widespread. One misconception is people think it's a weakness to have depression. So a lot of times people will come to my clinic and they'll say, you know, I'm a strong person. And I tell them, yes, you are. You're strong because you sought help, because you recognized. I mean, this is strength, to be able to talk about your feelings, to own up to it, to know yourself. I think people who seek help are extremely strong, and they are the brave, and I think they can sort of let other people know that you can seek help and it's not a sign of weakness.
I read somewhere, and I don't know if this is correct, that women are more prone to depression than men.
Women are twice as more likely to suffer from depression, but half as likely to kill themselves. So I think that there's a debate now. One is that there are hormonal factors, you know, women have the sort of, if you look at the menstrual cycle, the fluctuations in progesterone can lead to depression. There's a role issue. Women often have to juggle multiple roles. You've got to be a working mother, you know, there's a lot more pressure. Women tend to be more empathic, and so they tend sometimes to put the needs of others above themselves. So partly cultural, partly biological. But there's another side to the story, which is that men, when they're depressed, don't seek help. When they're depressed, they don't cry, they might get angry and alienate people around them. So the depressed man often is the lonely, isolated, maybe alcoholic person who is bereft of any company and therefore might end up committing suicide.
Now, it's important right now, Shyam, and I'll just come to you on this, Anna, as well, to talk about gradients of mental health, of mental illness. And there's depression, but there are many other syndromes as well. One of the things that comes up is, even if I go to a doctor, I'm depressed, even if I go to a doctor, what can the doctor do? Is this curable? Is this containable? Sometimes something that is not curable is containable, right? You have to find a way to live with it.
I think it's more than treatable, I think it's transformative. I think the process of taking care of your depression is a voyage of self-awareness, self-discovery, and optimizing your lifestyle and your mind. So I tell people, listen, you can continue to live, many people can continue and do live with depression throughout their lives. It's like carrying a heavy load on your head every day or bleeding slightly every day. You may not know it, you're depleted, you never achieve your potential. So I tell people, the fact that it reached a point where you had to seek help is the beginning of a positive transformation. Because the truth is, yes, it is like any other condition, but it's a little different. First of all, the thing is, it's not just a mind condition, it's a mind-body thing. And I think if we know that, we can destigmatize. We shouldn't even call it depression. You know, depression sounds like sadness. This is not sadness. This affects the brain, it affects your heart, it affects your gut,
there
it affects
hormones.
There are
actually real physiological feelings. I mean, like you said, it's that pit in your stomach.
Well, when you do brain scans, there are changes in the brain, there are changes in the hormones. You know, this is your body changing its function because of stress. And so when you take care of it, you transform into sort of your highest potential.
Anna, what do you find, whether in Deepika's case or your other patients, what is toughest for people when they're battling this? Is it what will the world think? Is it your being alone with yourself? What is it?
I think in my experience, one of the toughest things is a lot of them seek help without family knowing, because they don't get family support. So they come in completely
alone.
And they also say that we don't want family to know because they think we are indulging in attention seeking. And the other thing that really happens is that they're afraid at work. Suppose this is comes up at the workplace, then what happens to their livelihood? You know, because there is a stigma even at the workplace.
Hardest thing, see, we live in a society, it's still collectivist, we have people around us. But one thing people who suffer from depression will tell you, it's frighteningly alone. Even when you're amidst people, like Sylvia Plath, the author, said, you know, if I'm in a cafe in Bangkok or Paris, I'm always in my own glass jar, stewing in my sour air of depression.
And she killed herself.
It's like that. You carry that with you, and then we live in a society where we're together and yet you're apart. And so, you know, I think it's important for people to draw closer, not alienate the depressed person, to stand with them.
What was the most frightening experience you had in the year that you battled this? Where you know, like Shyam is saying, there's an acute sense of isolation. Sometimes being with people actually enhances that sense of, you know, feeling like a misfit in that situation.
I think for me the scariest was not understanding why it was happening or where it was coming from, because there is no one reason or cause, you know. So when you're sad, you know why you're sad. You've probably lost a job, you fought with someone, all kinds of things. I think when you're sad, you can sort of tell why you're sad. But for me, this, I couldn't understand why it was happening, where it was coming from, but it was just something, like he said, it was just this heaviness and this burden that I was feeling. And like I said, there were days when I just didn't want to wake up. You know, I just wanted to sleep because that was my escape.
And when you say you didn't want to wake up, had you lost interest in living?
I wouldn't say lost interest in living. And I think maybe fortunately I had people around me who sort of picked me up at probably the right point. But it was exhausting. Every minute was exhausting. You know, I didn't know what to do.
And other than not wanting to wake up and breaking down easily, what were the manifestations of it beyond that? Were you irritable? Were you not social? What were some of the other manifestations?
Loss of appetite. I'd feel hungry, but then when I actually sit down to eat, I'd hardly eat. Fortunately for me, I think I slept well, so that's one thing she'd keep. They both keep checking on me and making sure that I was sleeping okay, and I sleep okay. It would really depend, you know. There were days when I'd feel okay and I want to go out and be normal and like meet everyone, and there were days when I just wanted to be at home.
Anna spoke about the stigma at the workplace. Was there stigma at the workplace for you?
At that point, I don't think I'd shared it with anyone. Because I think I didn't want anyone to know, honestly, because if that was the case, I wouldn't be here today. But it was
more... You were figuring it out for yourself.
Yeah, it was just trying to figure out what is this and what is happening to me and, you know, is it a phase? Is it going to pass? Mm. You know, is this how... Or it was just... Yeah, it was just confusion. So not discussing with people at work was not because I didn't want to share it with them. And at the point, I think I was working with people who would really care about me and would go out of my way to make sure that I was okay. But I think my reason for not sharing was because I couldn't understand myself what was happening.
How did you first think that it might be depression?
I have had similar experiences with a couple of other family members in the past. I did know what the symptoms are and, you know, what a person goes through and what should be done. So that helped a lot.
But you know how Anna is speaking of how some people actually come in without family backing them. And so that process just becomes that much more lonely for them.
And Deepika is normally a very happy person. And like I said, she's strong enough to take on anything that, any problems that she faces. So, but this constant breaking down and crying was, as a mother, I knew instantly that it was...
But you know, like some of us do cry easily. So how do you distinguish between, you know, I'll cry while watching a movie, while reading a good book, while feeling sad, while feeling angry.
So I waited for a couple of days. I stayed back with her. I didn't rush back to Bangalore. I stayed back with her. I waited for a couple of days and I saw that there was a pattern when there were... At times she was feeling completely all right, completely normal, and at times she would just want to sit and cry. So I knew instantly what needed to be done. I knew instantly that I have to. Okay, now my biggest concern was which counselor or doctor do I get in? Because at that point of time, I didn't want, other than my immediate family, that is my husband and my other daughter, I didn't want anybody else to know. Because for the simple reason, as an ailment, I wouldn't have minded. I mean, there's nothing to hide about it. For the simple reason that things don't get written correctly about.
Yeah. I think even people who are not in the public eye would feel the same.
Yeah.
You know, you don't know what it is. You're trying to find your own grip over it, so to speak.
So ideally, I first thought of getting in someone from Bombay because she lives in Bombay.
Yeah.
And then my other daughter recommended, she said, why don't you get Anna? Because we know her on a personal level. She's a good friend and, you know, she will, keep it confidential.
Yeah.
So, and then when she spoke to Deepika, she immediately flew down and started the counseling sessions.
So what I think a lot of people will want to understand, and then I'll bring in Shyam and Anna into this, is the dualism of your emotions. So like you said, you were locking yourself in your makeup van or in a hotel room, having a weep and then going out and, you know, wearing a face for the world, so to speak. In the middle of it, you're also battling Times of India for photographs, you know, of your cleavage, saying, I have a right to define. Just because I'm on the screen, it doesn't mean that you can project me in any way you want to. You have a bizarre AIB roast controversy chasing you. You have people wanting you to talk about your latest movie. You have to sparkle on screen. How do you battle some police case on one end, some Times of India on the other, some, you know, crazy fans on the third, and then inside you there's something else going on? So I just think it's so important to understand how you juggle that dualism.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't know.
We used to have text conversations
about that
in the night at about,
because some of these things are adding to anxiety. You know, the last time I was interviewing Deepika, for example, was when she'd taken a position on how, you know, how dare you photograph me in this way? My body is my own. You can't use it to sell your pictures. And then more recently, you've got this police FIR in this bizarre roast controversy, which should never have been one. But my question is not about those issues. My question is, you have this added anxiety. You're on screen. You have to act. You have to earn a living. You have to do public functions. And there are these accompanying controversies. So how do you... Do you have any answer?
First, I want to say that this is her task. Being in the public eye is immensely difficult. But
isn't it much tougher? No doubt about it.
Because it's called emotional self-management. The hardest thing for any human being, and that's why I said this is a sign of strength that you're able to do this. The treatment and recovery ensures that it's not a struggle anymore.
Mm.
But to really answer the question, why is there a conflict? It's because the human brain is created like that. God or nature created our brain to have one layer which generates emotions like fear and anger. Another layer which kind of sits on top, that's our logical brain. So that's the brain we're using to talk to each other. Now, these two are not linear circuits, they're parallel. So you can have emotions coming to your brain. You know those emotions are not logical. You shouldn't be feeling it, but you can't help yourself because the neurology is like that.
So that your mind is constantly at war with itself.
Your brain is in
right?
conflict with each other, with different parts in conflict with each other.
But, you know, Eliot had that famous line of wearing the faces for the faces that I will meet. And I think for Deepika, my question was really about, I mean, if you are going to an office space which is still not public, every camera isn't chasing you, every cell phone isn't asking for a selfie, every newspaper isn't writing about you. I mean, I imagine the claustrophobia just doubles up.
I just want to say, you know, I always admire every person who is able to do that. And, you know, Deepika sort of represents what's happening in a smaller way in companies, organizations all over India. When we go and we've given some talks in companies, we will have people coming to us and talking about depression that they have been carrying for years. And I want to, you know, just bow down to them and say, how could you do it? Second, I want to tell them, you don't have to do this. You don't have to suffer. There are a lot of people who are suffering like this, putting on that mask, smiling and struggling. It's
so
incredibly difficult.
Did you feel suffocated by the mask you had to wear?
No, I feel like I was on autopilot in a sense, you know. Of course, there's one side of me that's saying, listen, you have to be professional, you have to reach shoot on time, you have to do this interview because you've committed to it. There's all these professional commitments. And there's that part of me which is saying, you have to do this, you have to do this, you have to do this.
But there's a part inside you saying, I don't want to wake up today. So where's the meeting point between these two, this dialogue? How does it reach a midpoint?
That's the strength, I think.
Yeah. I really don't know.
And I think family support matters a lot, yeah, because we would keep telling her, look, if you're not enjoying your work, if you're feeling overstressed, you need not
do it.
Yeah, you need not push yourself to, and this is something I keep telling both my daughters, or even my husband for that matter. It's brilliant to have goals, targets, wanting to achieve something in life, but don't push yourself to an extent that it takes a toll on your health. But like she said, there were days when she was
okay,
and there were moments or times when she would want to, you know.
But did you ever?
I think that strength again to pick yourself up and do what you have to do also comes from within.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I think I was very, very fortunate that I didn't dip to a level where I couldn't do any of that. I think fortunately I had my mom, and then the doctor stepped in at a point where I could do what I had to do and take care of myself as well. And I think from then on my life has really changed. You know,
before I ask you how you came out of it, I do want to ask you, did you ever feel, picking up on your mom's point, I don't want to go on the set, I don't want to do this movie, I don't want to give this interview, I don't want one more stupid journalist asking me one more stupid question?
I don't know, I really don't think I questioned my work. Actually, like I said, sometimes I think it really depended on where I was swinging and where I was going at that point.
You didn't think of giving it all up, ever? You didn't have those days?
No, I've worked.
Yes.
Actually, there was a point that she has immense grit, because when I came into Bombay, she had been shooting and
shooting nights. Yeah.
And she's shooting the whole night, and she's doing dance sequences, and then I come in on an early morning flight, she's waiting for me, so she's awake the whole day. But there was immense grit in her. And then as the time went by, you know, there would be these, we would have these, while she's in at work, we would have this text messaging going on between her and me, you know. So she created a space simultaneously where she could express herself, what was happening in her private world, and then go out and face the cameras again. And I really want to share that it was, to me, it was really her, the way she used her vulnerability as a strength, because day after day, she was, you know, continuing her responsibilities in her job. And she would text me saying, you know, I have this feeling of emptiness. Yeah. There's emptiness in me. And yet, then the next thing is she's back to work.
What do you mean by emptiness? I know what you mean, but yeah, I want you to try and maybe tell people who are listening to this, what does it mean?
I think physically what is happening is there's this weird pittish feeling, emptiness.
Is it anxious or is it blank?
It's a bit of both. You know, my breathing was different. My breathing wasn't like deep breaths, it was very shallow, uneven breaths, sometimes gasping for breath, feeling empty in my stomach. And they explained it as that, the pittish feeling, and I think that's the first thing I said to them, because that was that thing that just wouldn't go. It felt like a knot in my stomach. You know, I feel like whenever I've had, like if I've had malaria, or if I've say hurt my ankle, I always had my mind to help me recover. What do I do in a case like this where my mind itself is
you not can't do mind over matter in
yeah.
this one, right?
Yeah. So yeah. Now my mind is not talking to me. So now where do I go? Now what do I do? That was the constant, and I kept talking to myself and I'd get no answers.
And you're in an industry, just to bring this slightly global pattern that you would see, that whether you have the Robin Williams or you have the Parveen Bawi closer home, or you have, you know, you read this every day, that they're almost, Shyam, help me here, is there any linkage, has science found any linkage between very creative, very public, very intense sort of larger than life existences, and then
that's an interesting question,
because I'm just, the names are coming to me,
sure.
You know, Meena Kumari, Parveen Bawi here, Robin Williams.
Right. Yeah. Well, they've done studies actually. There's a psychiatrist who studied extensively the biographies of a lot of creative people all over the world. And she actually found that, yes, people like Tchaikovsky, Mozart, Beethoven, Abraham Lincoln, creative types, people who have done a lot in life have gone through their turbulent emotions. There seems to be a gene in some cases which, when it predisposes you to creativity, it also tends to give you these ups and downs in
your
mood.
Because creative people are more intense, and therefore there is that.
Well, some believe that the mood actually helps you be creative. Because when you're feeling down, you tend to introspect about life. I want to make one thing clear. See, sadness is good. Sadness is part of the human experience. We all need to feel sad.
Yeah.
What we're talking about here is depression. And depression is not sadness.
No, I'm talking about depression.
But
the names I've taken are people who were depressed.
No, so the flip side is, some people say, that why treat something which may be a fuel to creative pursuit? And this has been one big debate for years. But today what we are seeing is that no, you can actually optimize someone's mood and retain, in fact, enhance creativity.
Did you feel that somewhere it's a offshoot of the creative industry?
No. No? I didn't think then, and I don't think now. I mean,
but they do say that those who live under the arc lights tend to be lonelier.
I think it depends.
Just because there's such a dysfunctionality in that kind of attention on somebody all the time, that somewhere to live the normal life, whatever normal is,
sure, but
becomes
I think
tougher.
I think that also has to do with the kind of upbringing that I've had,
yeah.
The kind of normalcy that I've had in my life.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's family, whether it's friends. For me,
for her, this is a career. And
you know, it's not,
life doesn't define
her.
No, no. And life after this is going to be as normal as anyone else. So.
And it has been.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like my life is... Okay, yes, it's changed in terms of the fame and the success and the number of eyeballs on you all the time. But I'd like to believe that it's not changed my ideology, the person that I am. And then I have people like Anna and my mom and my friends who tell me that.
Yeah. I just want to get last thoughts from all of you. What is the one thing you want to say to somebody out there who's battling with depression? Shyam, I'll start with you.
I want to say that this is nothing to be ashamed of, that this is not a weakness, that this is not madness or nothing you have to hide from, that there is help and you don't have to suffer,
yeah.
And that in seeking help and trying to get through this, you will actually enhance your life in a very positive way. And this is sort of a warning call. 36% are suffering, more will suffer, and if we do this, then we can transform ourselves.
I just want to say that this is not an illness that only happens to a particular group of people. It happens to anyone. And here's a living example that Deepika the star is Deepika the human being.
Yeah.
And it can happen to any of us, and not to be ashamed of it.
Yeah. As a parent to other parents.
First of all, the person going through this should be able to talk about what they are going through to people close to them. Like in her case, if she had not told me about it, we would be happily living in Bangalore, not even knowing that she is going through all this. We would have got to know at a much later stage. So talk about what you're going through to people close to you. For the people to whom you have spoken to, I would say that don't just dismiss it. Try to shove it under the carpet or try to dismiss it as, you know, as attention seeking or mood swings and all that. Try to find out, and if it is an ailment that is bothering the person, don't hesitate to get professional help. Don't hesitate to talk about it to people around you, friends. I mean, there is nothing to hide about it. It's like any other ailment. Today, if people question me, I'm happy to talk about her experiences. I'm happy to help others, get the
confronted,
right...
Yeah. How did you come out of it? Let's end with something. You feel you went to hell and back, as you said. Do you sometimes worry it'll come back? If it comes back, will you be less scared of it this time?
Definitely. I think after having been through what I have, I think I've started reading a lot. I've started understanding. I've started realizing that it's not just me, and because of who I am or the profession that I'm in. Really, I think the ratio is 1:4. So that really means that all of us sitting here right now know somebody who has or is going through. It's that common.
Yeah. How did you come out of it? Could you have done it without medicine? Sometimes people feel I can do it without medicines. They resist that.
I think, first of all, I would not have been able to do it if I didn't have this support system.
Yes.
If I didn't have my mom, if I didn't have my friends, if I didn't have my father, who spoke to me and said, it's okay to go to a doctor, it's okay to go to a psychologist, it's okay to go to a psychiatrist, and it's okay to take medication.
Yeah.
I think the medication part was really needed a lot of convincing.
That's what I'm saying, because I know that the biggest resistance is
the
to
resistance
medication.
Was to see Shyam, the resistance was to take the medication.
It happened in different stages, but I think my most resistance was towards medication.
Yes.
And it was my parents who said, you know, when you have a headache or when you have any, whatever, you don't think twice. When you have a fever, you take medicine.
And during that phase, one of us was constantly there with her, either me or my husband or my daughter, to make sure that
she had the medicine. Because people will say, I'll take it
yes.
and then not take
yes.
it. So last thoughts today, to somebody who's feeling like you felt, who's feeling that emptiness, who's feeling that pit in their stomach, who's crying easily.
That you're not the only one. You know, don't feel like this is only happening to you. And that is, I think, one of the most common feelings that people will go through. They're going to feel like, ye mere saath kyun ho raha hai? And why is this only happening to me? Realize that we're all together, we're all in this together.
Yeah.
And most importantly, that there is hope.
Yeah.
It can be prevented, there is cure, and we need to treat this like anything else.
Well, I think it's extraordinarily brave of you. I really do. I don't say that to too many guests on this program. It's usually a very different dynamic. So I just want to thank you and give you a big hug.
Thank you.
And thank you so much.
Thank you.
From Deepika, we hope today that so many other people, just to remind you of the statistics, 36% of India is depressed. And that is only the reported numbers. We also have the highest suicide rate in the world. It's time to lift the stigma. It's time to break the silence. We hope Deepika's story helps you do that in some way. Thank you for watching. Goodbye.